You're listening to Discordia, over 50 years of student activism at Concordia University. On CJLO 1690 AM or online at cjlo.com.
My name's Piper, and I'm an independent artist, musician, and academic invested in researching alternative modes of storytelling. I live, work, and create within the unceded lands currently known as Montreal, and I'm currently enjoying engaging in forms of education and knowledge sharing situated outside of the academy after completing my master's thesis here at Concordia in spring of 2024. My background in campus community radio spans over a decade across several stations, and I'm very pleased to be here at CJLO, co-producing Discordia for you.
I'm Sydney. I'm originally from Cataraqui or Kingston and have been living in Jojage since 2010. I recently finished a PhD in interdisciplinary humanities at Concordia on the rise of magic, astrology, and related occult practices as resources for community building and political work in Montreal. I've done talk radio on antennas and CKUT, and I think of radio as a perfect methodology and companion to community-based research and activism. I'm looking forward to delving into the archives, making connections with other activists, and finding through lines in student solidarity movements in Montreal over the last half century. Previously on Discordia, we began looking back at the events of September 2002 that have become known as the Netanyahu riot.
In this episode, we continue to explore the events and fallout of that day, when protesters ultimately prevented Benjamin Netanyahu from speaking on the Concordia campus. With the help of our guests, you'll hear Omar offering an eyewitness account, Aaron reflecting on Jewish anti-Zionist organizing, and Ali drawing connections to present-day pro-Palestinian organizing and the status of the BDS movement at Concordia. We discuss questions of free speech on campus and how these events changed the face of the Concordia Student Union.
Part 1 aired on January 13th at 6 p.m. and can be found in our archives at cjlo.com, as well as on SoundCloud and Spotify under Discordia, over 50 years of student activism. Listen back to get the full story on this moment in Concordia's student activism history.
So just to recap, 2002 saw Netanyahu between terms as Israeli Prime Minister. He had been in office from 1996 to 1999, and he went on to hold the office again from 2009 to 2021, and obviously presently since 2022, making him the longest serving prime minister in Israel's history. Back in 2002, Netanyahu was already alleged to have committed or to have been directly complicit in gross abuses of human rights in the Palestinian occupied territories and the state of Israel, according to an arrest warrant that was issued by anti-Zionist and pro-Palestinian activists prior to his Concordia visit, which was scheduled for September 9th, 2002, which happened to also be the first day of the fall semester at Concordia.
My name's Omar. I was a undergraduate student at Concordia at the time of the Netanyahu riots.
Omar was there that day in 2002.
So I was at the protest. I was mainly outside of the hall building with like a group of other protesters, watching what was going on around me and just seeing how everything kind of escalated super quickly. I feel like a lot of the reason to why it kind of escalated quickly too, I mean, leading up to the actual protest, there were, you know, the tension around that protest and around that, the speaking engagement that Netanyahu was coming for was really building over weeks leading up to it. I mean, I think groups around Concordia were trying to talk to the administration to try and get it shut down. I think they had more than enough reason to have a person like that denied from having a platform at Concordia. And, you know, I remember around that time too, having conversations with other people about this sort of stuff and, you know, the usual go-to about freedom of speech and allowing to have different opinions and such like that. But I think you kind of have to draw the line when, like, for example, I think there's a difference between having Pierre Poilievre come to the campus and talk about something versus having somebody who is, you know, a literal war criminal who is responsible for people's families being put in prison or people's families losing their homes or people's families who have family members or friends who have been murdered. And I mean, we already can see who Netanyahu has become currently, but the man at that time already had blood on his hands. And I really only feel within the last 5 years that the situation with the people in Palestine or even in Gaza currently has been started to be taken seriously, or to be taken seriously on not exactly a mainstream level, but in more of a, more people in the general public are well aware of what's going on over there than they were back then. And I think that also kind of plays into it too. But the tensions just were so high leading up to that protest. And I feel like you've probably been to protests too before, obviously, where you kind of get the sense that something's probably going to go down, and you kind of have that kind of heightened sense of alarm or alertness to make sure that if something goes down, that you're prepared to take care of yourself and those around you.
Yeah.
And there definitely was a moment where you kind of started getting that, like your spidey sense started tingling around then. And I think a lot of that happened was when you definitely saw the police taking more of an intimidating presence with the protesters. The overall vibe of it was definitely unnerving. It really felt really, really bizarre to be at, you know, a place of education and it to be basically locked down in this extreme, almost militarized manner, which felt like inherently, ultimately wrong for them to set it up like that. But I think everybody who was there felt very strongly about the reasons to why they wanted that event shut down.
Yeah, I wanted to ask, how aware were you of the issue of Palestine and Israel prior to this event?
Oh, very aware, very aware. I mean, like, it's one of those issues that I feel like anybody from either a Muslim or an Arab background is extremely aware of it. And, you know, just based on people that we know within our community who have lived through the occupation or who still live under occupation or who have family that is in occupation, you hear all these stories about all of this stuff that are, you know, firsthand account of what's happening there. And then the more you read into it yourself, then the more you start seeing that the stuff that you actually hear either within, you know, the what's fed to you via the mainstream media or the media you consume, especially at that time, is not really the whole story about it. The Palestinians really are a people who have been totally abandoned by everybody. I think one of the nicest things that I noticed at the protests over the last while with what's happening in Gaza lately is that the protests are very intersectional. And I think the reality is that anybody who is a minority or who has been subject to any sort of discrimination can understand other people who are going through this sort of stuff. Anybody who goes through hardship can understand other person's hardships. Everybody kind of has this common ground if they understand, for lack of a better term, suffering. And nobody wants that for anybody else. And I think the encouraging thing, especially when I talk to, for lack of better terms, white friends of mine about this, who feel really discouraged or hopeless with how sometimes it feels like, you know, you go to these protests, you write these letters, you write these emails, and it still feels like it's amounting to nothing, especially when you look at the death toll just continuing to rise and the suffering continuing to rise over there. But what I keep telling them is that I've never seen this diverse of a group of people engaging with this to this degree, where I feel that so many of my friends now, or so many people in general that I know now, know about this situation and have the right facts about the situation now, and who are asking the right questions about this situation than what it was in 2002.
In the things that I've read about this protest, there's this really big fixation on like the broken window. And, you know, I've seen the footage. Police started beating people, and then the window was broken in response. People from the street were trying to get in, presumably to help these people being beaten and arrested. And then, you know, they're pushed back with pepper spray. Or whatever. Yeah. So it's always, people hate violence when it's not in the hands of their friends, I guess. But
people hate violence when it doesn't benefit them. That's basically what it is, which is hilarious because, you know, we paint ourselves as a very nonviolent society. When we're a very violent society, it's just a state-controlled violence, which is really messed up to be pro that sort of stuff. I mean, the fact that I see people now complaining about the protests happening currently, you know, with statements something like, we should just send in the police to just beat them all up and stuff. And I'm like, is that really the way you want to solve this sort of stuff? And I think ultimately, too, people need to understand, like, why are tensions so high about this sort of stuff? Why are people so upset about something? And it sounds like lunacy for me to have to say a statement like that when people can't understand. People are so upset because tens of thousands of people have been massacred. It's extremely frustrating, but that's what occupation does. Occupation just tries to break everyone's spirit or everyone's. I mean, it's just essentially, aside from physical occupation, it's a cudgel of gaslighting. And that's ultimately what it is. It's everyone is in some sort of form or other under this sort of occupation. And I think that's why, too, you see the intersectionalities, because anyone who has been discriminated against or faces discrimination sees themselves in what's going on over there, or sees a potential, you know, a very frightening and awful potential of that happening to themselves as well, too. You know discrimination. You know what this is like. You know what it feels like to ultimately feel different in a room of people. And it's an awful feeling. It's an awful feeling. It's not awful to be different. It's an awful feeling when people make you feel othered. Yeah. And this is like a systemic government sponsored way of feeling othered that, like, you know, it's been truly rough, especially in Quebec. I feel like over the last 12 years or something, and like I'm born in Canada. I'm born in Quebec. I speak French. Like I went through French education, but I will never be considered Quebecois per their idea of what a Quebecois person is. And I think that transcends to all sorts of things too, like being a brown Muslim man, even though I'm, you know, ultimately at the end of the day, like a cisgender dude, you know, but there's still that understanding that, like, yeah, man, like I can understand everyone's situation with what discrimination they've been through is obviously different, but you can definitely understand it. Like if we both talk about our experiences of various discrimination or various situations that we've dealt with, they'll be different, but we both would be like, oh, I know exactly what you're talking about, you know? Yeah. And I think that's especially too, like when I go to these protests and I see trans people, I see LGBTQ people, I see Black people, I see anybody else like that. And it's just like, yeah, these are my peoples, you know? Mm-hmm. And I feel like that makes me want to take part in protests for them and go to those sort of protests as a result, you know? Because if they're here for, you know, like I'm not Palestinian, but I see a parallel or I see a similarity with those people. But on the other flip side of that coin too, like I can understand what a trans person or a gay person is going through with this sort of stuff too. And so I would want to be able to be there for them if they're there for me, you know. We live in really messed up times, man. Like it's just...
But it's so true. Yeah, everybody, like we all need to have each other's backs, because like our fights are way more connected than not. Do you have any final comments?
You know, the one thing I really think about that day the most, that sticks out the most with me, well, there's two things, I guess, but one thing that really sticks out the most with me is that after the windows were broken and the arrests were made and people were still outside, protesting, but there was this eerie calmness afterwards. Like I don't know how to explain it. It was almost like both sides just kind of got it all out, and it was just like this really eerie calmness of like a group of people outside the hall building, and then you had cops in riot gear just lined up across the front of like the doors of the hall building. There just lined up out front, just standing there. Nobody was really doing anything. Nobody was really intimidating anybody at that point. But it was just like, I think the hall building had pretty much essentially been shut down then at that point. And I had this weird thought that I was like, you know, I've never really been up close to a riot policeman. So I walked right up to the front, and it was just like, this is so bizarre that this is my school. This is my school. And this is where this all had kind of gone down to. And it was just, you know, just walked right up there and just kind of looked up and down the row of the riot police that were there. And then that was it. Then I left. I went across the street to the student services building and renewed my ID card, which I had to renew. Yeah. So yeah, it was a wild day. It's definitely weird to think like that's how messed up like that stuff had gotten. But yeah, once after that window got broken and the cops just really clamped down with the arrest, then it was just like this eerie calm, like I was saying, after like a storm. I don't know what other observations I have. I mean, like, I think just how they kind of shut down any sort of protest or political discourse for, I think, a few weeks or something. Because, I mean, kind of laughable in a way. I mean, like, I feel like there's other ways that they probably could have handled it in some sort of mediative manner versus just being like, we're just not going to do anything now. But yeah, I think it really did kind of change the political climate at the university for a
So, as we've just heard, the Zionist student group Hillel had invited Netanyahu to speak at Concordia while he was on a speaking tour in North America with financial backing from the Asper Foundation. And despite warnings that this would prove a security issue and requests to the university from Solidarity with Palestinian Human Rights, or SPHR, to shut it down, the visit was approved by Rector Frederick Lowy and planned for September 9th in the main auditorium of the Hall building on Concordia's downtown campus. In response, hundreds of people, mainly students like Omar, showed up in protest, with some occupying the building. Police clashed with protesters and can be seen in the NFB documentary Discordia beating students back and firing pepper spray inside of the Hall building, and several arrests were made. The RCMP concluded that they could not guarantee Netanyahu's safety and called off the talk, so he didn't appear on campus and instead holed up in the Ritz-Carlton Hotel, where he gave a press conference.
Although the charges laid by police were later dropped, students saw special disciplinary powers granted to Rector Frederick Lowy, including a moratorium on tabling in the Hall building for all student groups and a ban on discussing the Middle East outside of personal conversation and relevant class discussions. According to Concordia's September 26th issue of the Thursday Report, Sabine Friesinger may have been the first person to defy the temporary ban on posters, but you could hardly quarrel with the message she taped up for a crowd of reporters last Monday afternoon. Stop the killing in Israel and Palestine.
This was September, basically, end of September, the moratorium was implemented. But immediately the next day, we broke this moratorium on. It became our mission to be like, no, and made a banner drop, and we continued to organize with flyers and so on. It became even more of a student union issue than at that point, because the university was trying to suppress some of our members' rights to distribute information and present a different point of view.
That's the voice of Sabine Friesinger, who was a CSU president in 2002. You can hear more from our interview with her in part one.
On October 16th, CSU VP of Comms Eve Engler was escorted off campus by a convoy of 20 police vehicles for tabling for the Day of Action Against the Free Trade Area of the Americas, which went against the moratorium. The following day, hundreds of students gathered in protest on the mezzanine, fed by People's Potato. Despite a court injunction from entering campus, students escorted Engler to his exam that following day, as he details in his book, Playing Left Wing. In addition to student refusal to recognize the ban, external pressure came from groups such as Amnesty International, who wrote to Rector Lowy urging the Board of Governors to reconsider its decision.
In one of the many letters to the rector, one student wrote, "Why did you ask the board for special powers to circumvent the Code of Rights and Responsibilities to discipline the students? The code is the mechanism the university decided upon to hear cases against students. It is somewhat authoritarian for one person to have this amount of power over students."
There's also a photo here of CSU execs with tape over their mouths holding signs in protest of the moratorium. It's kind of difficult to read, but it says something like, "Who's defending freedom of speech now?" and "Silence. The university demands that you renounce your civil liberties."
According to Rector Frederick Lowy, funding concerns Trump students' right to protest and free expression. He says the violence of September 9th will have an impact on fundraising. University life has been dominated by the Mideast issue, yet it only affects a fraction of our 29,000 students.
"The only violence is the violence of their attack on freedom of speech," said MP Sven Robinson on the moratorium before a crowd of around 300 people who gathered outside of the Hall building after an injunction prevented him and two others from speaking inside. Khaled Muammar accused the Board of Governors of bullying and intimidation, adding that while Muslims and Arabs represent one-sixth of Concordia's students, they are absent from the Board of Governors.
The moratorium was lifted after about 2 months. And the day after it was lifted, Hillel, so the Zionist student group that originally invited Netanyahu to speak, returned to table on the Hall building mezzanine, and they distributed a recruitment brochure for the Israel Defense Forces, or IDF. It said something like, "We've jihad enough" on the front of it.
You do know there's laws against recruiting for the armed force of a foreign power?
No, it's a volunteering. We're not recruiting. It's just a program. There's a lot of programs. Here, let me show you.
If these guys recruited for Hamas or Hezbollah, you'd be screaming blue murder.
An offended student filed an internal charge against the Hillel Club under the University Code of Conduct. A couple of days later, a motion comes to student council asking that Hillel's budget be frozen and its club privileges suspended until they apologize. This motion passes 8-1. The CSU pushed through the motion for going due process.
Can I ask where Hillel is? Were they invited to be here today?
We weren't invited.
Did you invite them?
I just speak? No.
How come?
Hillel then filed a $100,000 suit and demanded an apology over the CSU's decision to impose sanctions on the student group after the flyers were found on their table. The Canadian Foreign Enlistment Act strictly prohibits recruitment for foreign armed services on Canadian campuses.
The lawsuit was later suspended, but I think it took a good year or so for it to actually be thrown out. And the judge eventually ruled that Hillel should exhaust all its avenues within the system at Concordia before turning to the courts, basically saying it was a waste of time to bring it this high. The judge also disagreed with Hillel's contention that it was being targeted because of its Jewish character, pointing out that a majority of the CSU executives at the time were Jewish themselves. So I guess we see an example here of Hillel using anti-Semitism charge that we're so used to seeing in the media these days around pro-Palestinian organizing, and the judge in this case sees through that and thinks of it as a different kind of issue.
You're listening to Discordia on CJLO 1690 AM.
My name is Aaron Lakoff. I'm originally from Montreal, but I grew up mostly in Toronto. And when I was in Toronto, that's probably when I first got really into radical activism. I was involved in a pretty exciting and big group in Toronto at the time called the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty, or OCAP, which was an anti-capitalist direct action anti-poverty group. And that was kind of like how I first got my feet wet in radical activism. And then I moved back to Montreal when I was 19 to start school at McGill. Although going to McGill was a little bit just like an excuse for me to come to Montreal because I really wanted to be in Montreal. And then when I was in Montreal, I got really inspired by anarchist and anti-authoritarian organizing that was happening here. So my politics kind of, I would say, shifted a little bit when I came here in a more anarchist orientation.
We spoke with student activist Aaron Lakoff, who discusses some of the realities of being an anti-Zionist Jew and activist in Montreal.
I would still say, like, that's kind of how I align my politics today, is broadly speaking anarchist and anti-authoritarian. And I'm Jewish, secular Jewish, and so I think the Netanyahu riot, I'm excited to talk about it because I think for me, it was definitely part of my coming out story as an anti-Zionist Jew. You know, all anti-Zionist Jews have like some sort of like a coming out story in terms of like how we came to a politic of solidarity with Palestine, and that was definitely an awakening moment for me.
What was it about this event, how it unfolded, the aftermath on Concordia campus or in Montreal at large, that fed into your own kind of, as you put it, awakening into anti-Zionism?
2 weeks after I'd moved to the city, I wanted to get involved in Montreal activism. And so I started hearing about this protest. A lot of people were talking about it was going to be big against Netanyahu, who he wasn't actually prime minister of Israel at the time, but, you know, he already had a lot of blood on his hands as a war criminal. You know, certainly people at the time saw his role in terms of violating the Oslo Accords and the so-called peace process and expanding illegal Israeli settlements in the West Bank. And so activists in Montreal had drawn up an arrest warrant for him to kind of like try to do a citizen's arrest when he came, which is just, to me, it's so fascinating to talk about it in 2025 when there is a literal arrest warrant out for Netanyahu issued by the International Criminal Court. If only the ICC had listened to activists at Concordia back in the day. But I heard about this protest and it was potentially going to be like kind of like rocky. And I wasn't totally sure if I wanted to go because I come from a Jewish family. I definitely was not like out to my family in terms of being critical of Israel. But to be honest, I actually just like wasn't very familiar with the situation in Israel-Palestine. you know, the Second Intifada was still in its heyday back then. Like, the Second Intifada started in 2000. So people had been talking a lot about Palestine, but I was young, right? Like, I was 19 at the time. So I hadn't really, like, come into that struggle, so to speak. And then it happened, and, you know, because I wasn't there, I don't necessarily want to insert my own narrative, but what I very clearly remember at the time is the media coverage in Montreal. And I was a little bit intimidated by that, right? Like, at the time, I think I was still sussing out my feelings around property damage and whether or not property damage constituted a legitimate form of resistance. You know, today I have much clearer political viewpoints on that. Of course, the famously, right, like the big window of the Hall building on Maisonneuve got smashed. And there was some uglier moments, right? Like, there was definitely a few anti-Semitic incidents happening. You know, we heard stories of people having their kippahs pulled off, you know, Jewish students getting spat on. But there was undeniably a lot of anti-Palestinian racism that day too. But I think it's important not to lose sight of the bigger picture, which is, like, on that day, there was this very stage-managed event that was set up for a war criminal at Concordia, and Concordia let it happen on their downtown campus with a pre-selected guest list and with riot police all over campus. And I think the most important thing for me to retain is the bravery of Palestinian and Arab students that day, and anti-Zionist Jewish students, to stand up against Netanyahu and to say, yeah, war criminals are not welcome on our campus. But that being said, I mean, that wasn't a conclusion that I came to, I think, until several months later, because I think, you know, reading the media coverage about the broken windows and, like, the comparisons to Kristallnacht, like, as a Jew, that's something that I think is very hard to digest, especially when you're 20 years old and still really trying to figure out your feelings around all this. And what was interesting about the time period is that you had the Second Intifada happening in Palestine. You had Netanyahu come to Montreal. But I would say, like, the larger thing happening in the Middle East was the lead up, shall we say, to the American invasion of Iraq. And so I was heavily involved at McGill with a group called McGill Students Against War and Racism. So we were doing a lot of anti-war mobilizing on the McGill campus against the war in Iraq. And I think I personally felt much safer being involved in that issue because it didn't involve, like, all the baggage of Jewish identity. But then I also remember at the same time, like, so many friends and comrades making this point that you can't just talk about Iraq in isolation. You know, what we're talking about in the Middle East is imperialism, which is a larger system, and Israel very much factors into that, and their occupation of Palestinian lands very much factors into that too. And so I think I started to realize this at the time, but I wasn't ready to come out yet in terms of, like, my support for Palestine. But I think that all started to change in the months following, and it changed pretty quickly just because there was so many events happening on both on the McGill and the Concordia campus. And I don't remember what it was. Like, I don't think there was one aha moment that tipped me off and said, okay, like, I have to use my voice as a Jew to stand in solidarity with Palestine. I think it was a lot of personal relationships. Like, someone I was dating at the time was also an anti-Zionist Jew and had just been to Palestine. And, like, she was very formative for me in terms of kind of, like, pushing me to speak out. Yeah, to bring it back to Concordia, what I do remember that was really fascinating is there was this period of, let's call it, like, a manufactured crisis at Concordia in the aftermath, where they were, you know, Concordia was in international headlines, and, you know, it got, like, these weird monikers, like Gaza U, and, you know, all sorts of people were saying, like, it was such an unsafe campus to be on, and, like, a beehive of activism. And I remember really clearly the administration's response to the Netanyahu riot was to completely ban any event about Israel-Palestine for several months. Like, I don't remember how long that ban lasted, But the ban was really intense because so many students were talking about the Intifada and about Israel-Palestine and about the war in Iraq at the time. So they silenced, you know, or they censored, rather, all Palestinian events just as much as pro-Israel events. But the problem when you apply a blanket ban like that is you're essentially pushing the whole thing under the rug. Tensions are still going to boil. And when you silence everyone like that, effectively the power still stays in the hands of the oppressor, right? Like, Israel is still occupying Palestine. You know, Zionist students don't necessarily need to hold their events to ensure that material and moral support keeps flowing to Israel, right? So in effect, that ban really emboldened the pro-Israel or the Zionist side. And I remember it was a really scary time for Palestinian students at Concordia, because students who had been involved in the protests, like whether or not they'd broken the law or not, started to face academic trials, right? So legal stuff aside, people were put on trial by Concordia. And I remember there was specifically a group of Palestinian students and their supporters that formed in the aftermath of that. And I would attend those meetings. The name is escaping me, specifically of this group. But we would meet at Cooper Concordia and basically talk about like how to come together to defend Palestinian students and others who are facing reprisals for their role in the demonstration. I think what's obvious about the Palestinian people and what makes them so inspiring is that even when like all these obstacles are thrown in their face, they're going to find ways to come together to build networks of support. And we saw that happen at Concordia. Yeah. And that's kind of like what stands out for me.
What, if anything, has like for you been a significant change or constant in the past 2 decades, like since this event, and in your own sort of experience as someone who is actively involved in Palestine? And you said you had been yourself as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, right? Because in a way, it's so tragic because the situation, especially in Gaza, is just so infinitely worse than I think anyone could have imagined 20 years ago, right? Like, it's just, there's just no words to even talk about this genocide anymore that's been going on for over a year. But then at the same time, I think where we need to draw hope is just like how far we've managed to push this global solidarity movement with the Palestinian people, and like how much we've managed to make Palestine solidarity like the fabric of everyday political and cultural life. And to give a few examples, I mean, I talked about the International Criminal Court, right? Like they issued an arrest warrant for Netanyahu this year. And that's incredible because people have been talking about, you know, doing citizen arrests of Netanyahu for decades. And I think there's this validation finally when you have these rulings, right? Like when the ICJ, the International Court of Justice, said there's a, you know, plausible possibility that Israel is committing genocide and has to do everything in its power to stop it. When you have the ICC coming out against Netanyahu and Gallant, you know, the defense minister, we couldn't have imagined these things 20 years ago, because I think Palestine solidarity still felt like this kind of like fringy thing that people on the radical left did, which I don't think is the case anymore. Like, you know, you see celebrities speaking out for Palestine, musicians and artists and actors. So that's inspiring. And then on the governmental level, no political party in Canada was willing to touch Palestine with a 10-foot pole back in 2022. To me, it's really incredible how much we've been able to push the Liberal Party, right? To the point where, like, you know, we've got the Liberals to basically say it's important that Canada stop sending weapons to Israel if they're going to be used to commit war crimes. And of course they're going to be used to commit war crimes. Like, what else are they going to use them for? I think there's been these really tangible victories. Also BDS, right? Like, I was involved in, like, some of the first Israeli apartheid weeks at Concordia, like, back in the 2000s. You know, the BDS movement officially launched internationally in 2005 and then Canada in 2006. So I was at the founding conference for BDS in 2006. And again, like, it felt fringe at the time, right? Like, it was only like some student groups and some labor groups who were talking about it. And now BDS, Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, is more or less a household name, right? Like, people know the acronym. People know what you're talking about when you're talking about boycotting Israeli apartheid, and so many people agree with it too. So I think that's where I try to draw some hope and some inspiration. But we know the situation is only getting worse, and it's going to take a lot more to change things.
That makes a lot of sense. It's sort of the bittersweet thing of like you say, having validation, but that the knowledge that validation only comes from, you know, how extreme the situation is, that it's like, that's the only way it's like emerged as possible to like push the Liberal Party in a certain direction or have like the mainstream comment on it. But yeah, it is sort of like having to hold both at the same time.
You're listening to Discordia on CJLO 1690 AM.
My name is Ali Salman. I am a Concordia student. I am part of the Concordia Student Union Council. I am here today to speak on this interview, and I honestly thank you for having me.
Pro-Palestinian student activist and CSU council member Ali Salman connects the events of 2002 to present-day organizing for Palestine. You'll hear more from this interview in a coming episode, where we take a deep dive into the student solidarity encampments for Palestine in Montreal and beyond.
I've been in the Palestinian movement for as long as even before October 7. I have been involved also in the encampment. I was a media rep during the encampment. I did typically a lot of the interviews with the mainstream media. And yeah, I'm till today, I'm kind of involved in the whole student movement on campus.
Just to situate us in the 2002 anti-Netanyahu protest, how did you come to know about it? And can you speak a bit to your understanding about what happened 23 years ago?
Yeah, how I came to know about it, first of all, was through Discordia. Discordia is a movie that you can find online. And through that movie, I actually learned what happened back then. And eventually, I met with a bunch of people who were there back then. I learned from them, and I got to know more in detail what happened.
What struck you in particular when you watched that movie? Is there anything that stood out to you in terms of some of the organizing tactics, a continuity or a difference with how things are organized today on campus?
Well, what struck me the most was how enraged the campus was. I mean, 2002 was a hell of a different context from now. Now we see, and there's no social media, there's nothing to spread the word as effective as it can be done now. So when I saw it, I was like, okay, the participation is really high and a lot of people are there, and people are enraged by Netanyahu being on campus. And I can't speak of the context back then, but I am sure that the students in general were not as mobilized as they are right now. So the response to it was kind of striking. It's still to this day, whenever I watch the videos and clips from back then, I'm like, that was something to see. It's amazing, honestly.
Something that I remember being consistent through the film, especially in the aftermath of the actual event on September 9th, was that a lot of people who maybe weren't necessarily involved in pro-Palestinian organizing before, got involved because it became a greater issue about repression from the university. What does academic freedom, what does freedom of speech mean? Mm-hmm. Can you speak to that, or any thoughts about either what you noticed emerge in those conversations in the film, or more broadly today, how free speech is maybe weaponized to repress Palestinian activists?
I mean, especially you mentioned academic freedom. I think that's the most weaponized today. When we speak of academic boycott, the thing that comes against that is the university saying, well, there's academic freedom. We think that people are allowed to, for example, have an exchange program with Tel Aviv and Bar-Ilan universities, although they are on occupied land and they have historically been involved in enabling the IDF. And Tel Aviv University, for example, is created the Dahe Doctrine, which means that they will literally eradicate the whole place in order to get their military point. I mean, that's besides the point, but the weaponizing of academic freedom and this repression, and I stumbled upon the newspapers back then, and I saw that one of the things that were present on campus that morning before the speech was dogs to smell potential dangers of bombs. These tactics of repression being used to a very extensive sense, and having these students, they're just normal students, and being portrayed as these savages that wanna create chaos while they just wanna shut down the speech of a war criminal. Mm-hmm. I think that's something that struck me, and going back to my point about freedom of speech and academic freedom, I think, like, I can't emphasize enough how academic freedom is weaponized, genuinely.
Yeah, it's quite a one-sided operation. I think Sabine was talking about how, I think SPHR had invited Norman Finkelstein to speak, and the administration was trying to intervene in that process and shut it down, but then when Netanyahu is invited, there's suddenly it becomes like, no, well, anyone should be able to occupy the hall building.
I mean, again, we saw the same thing last year when SPHR tried to invite Aaron Mate, and they announced that it was going to be on campus, mm-hmm. and the administration canceled it and they had to move it off campus. But then today we see that people like Yusuf Haddad and Shai Davidai, who are literally harassing students. I mean, of course, bringing Netanyahu is much worse, but these people have been harassing students wherever they go, however they move. They literally harass Concordia students, and Concordia decided that these events were not of high risk enough, mm-hmm. as I think they described that when Aaron Mata wanted to mm-hmm. come here. They were like, it's high risk, we can't let it go through. But today, when Yusuf Haddad and Shai Davidai came in, they were like, they turned a blind eye and they just didn't intervene.
And can you explain a little bit who those people are and what you mean by harassment?
Yeah, I mean, both of them, Yusuf Haddad and Shai Davidai, they both went into the Hive Cafe that's known to have shown solidarity with Palestine, and that has shown over the last year solidarity with the people of Gaza. For Shai Davidai's case, they've harassed on video staff members of the Hive, and security took quite a lot of time to intervene in that case, while we see them, surprise, very effective when it comes to things related to Palestine. And also Musab Hassan, who was invited to speak in McGill, but then was eventually shut down. Also, that's another example of people who are outrageous and who are not only openly anti-Palestinian, but they're just blatantly Islamophobic, have been allowed to come speak on campus in the name of free speech. I don't know if you saw the email sent by Angela Campbell after Musab Hassan was cancelled, but inside the email she mentioned that, I don't want to quote because I don't really remember, but it was something along the lines that it's sad to see this because it comes in the way of freedom of speech. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So we're seeing these same things being repeated 22 years later. Mm-hmm. You know, Netanyahu is a stain, eternal stain in the name of Concordia. Just like these people, like Yusuf Haddad and Shai Davidai and Musab Hassan, will be an eternal stain in the name of Concordia and McGill for years to come.
Absolutely, the idea of what constitutes risk and to whom obviously kind of influences what they see as an urgent kind of call to action or something that they should just kind of let slide, because there's a certain group of people who just are seen to be associated with risk, yeah. and a certain group of people who are associated with like vulnerability.
Today we see that this mobilization of people in the student movement has grown beyond grassroots, and the fact that so many associations and federations are getting involved in BDS and getting involved in striking for BDS and taking action for BDS. I think Concordia, when they shut down BDS in 2014, a decade later, I think they're looking back and they're like, I don't think they expected a decade later for it to come back that strongly. Which, speaking of, the CSU is gonna hold a special general meeting, because a petition was passed by students for the CSU to vote on adopting BDS and to mandate them, I believe, to bring it to the Board of Governors. And that SGM will be on the 29th. So we're going to really need people to show up for that.
The 29th of January,
yes.
What are the demands of the BDS movement as it's connected to Concordia?
Yeah, so Well, the boycotting, BDS boycott, divest, and sanction, the boycotting part would be Concordia boycotting from partnerships, boycotting partnerships with universities in the entity that either enable the genocide or are simply on occupied land. That's the first part of boycott, which is academic boycott, which has been repeated for a while on campus. Divestment would be to divest from weapons companies, which I believe Concordia for the past few months, especially after they saw the strikes and they saw the pressure that has been mounting from the student bureaucracy and the students on a grassroots level, I think they've seen that the pressure is mounting, and they claim, I think in a recent interview by Graham Carr on The Link, they claim that they divested because it does not suit their sustainability portfolio, whatever that means. But they still have partnerships with weapons companies like Lockheed Martin, Bombardier, Airbus. But it's five weapons companies, main essential weapons companies, that Concordia has partnerships with that are being demanded to be divested from and cut ties with. This is another part of the pressure of the student movement. We see this shift in language. I mean, back in November of 2023, I think SPHR had released a report back on a meeting they had with Graham Carr. And they said that in that meeting, he had mentioned something about how would Zionist students feel about divesting from weapons companies. Something along the lines. I don't remember exactly what the quote was, but it was something outrageous like that. I think he said even said how would Jewish students feel if they, like, as if Jewish students and weapons companies are mm-hmm. intertwined. It's outrageous. This is an outrageous statement. But anyway, we see this being shifted from that to now they claim that they have divested. So honestly, this is an important development in the student movement and in the movement for BDS.
You're listening to Discordia on CJLO 1690 AM.
So what do you think is going on here, given all of the different things we've read, the different people we've talked to, and how contentious we saw this event be on campus? How would you kind of describe the issue of free speech here and academic freedom, or what is actually being kind of struggled over?
Yeah, I think like many of our interviewees pointed out, there's a serious imbalance of power here. And when we're looking at freedom of speech on campus, I think it's really important to contextualize this event as I think our interviewees have, that this was not like a public open event. This was a really contentious event that people were being screened to enter. It was clearly meant for this specific group of Zionist students on campus. This wasn't really a speech for everybody. And I think there was a lot of tension and discussion over whether or not there was really any place for this, whether campus was the right place for this conversation in the first place.
There already are kinds of speech that are valorized and kinds of speech that are sanctioned. And the people who saw it as a paradox that Netanyahu was blocked from speaking, but that students were, for example, outraged that they themselves were also sanctioned from tabling or, you know, discussing this context, are missing the point that Palestine and Palestinian activism is already kind of laboring under conditions of repression. And therefore to sort of try to push back against someone like Netanyahu is actually attempting to even the playing field rather than this kind of equal two sides that are trying to yell louder over each other.
Yeah, and we've got a great clip from your interview with Sabine where she essentially says just that.
The issue, for example, of free speech, it can get weaponized a lot. You know, people were saying at the time, oh, but we have to defend Netanyahu's right to speech and so on. But there's always like this imbalance, right? There's this imbalance where like he had, after he was blocked from coming to Concordia, he had, I don't know, 100 cameras and microphones in front of him talking, recording what he was saying, you know? So was his speech really hampered there? Like what he had to say there, his very dehumanizing response at the time, was that cut? You know, was that? No, people heard it. So he has the power of speech. It's an issue of balance, too, in terms of like what speech gets shut down and what speech is accepted. For me, I always look at it in terms of like who's trying to suppress the speech and for what, you know? And what is the speech that is being said? Like, for sure, right-wing hate speech I don't promote, you know? And that's me, you know? But so I think it was a cop-out to be saying that Netanyahu's speech mm-hmm. was broken. It's the opposite. Palestine organizing was trying to be suppressed with this whole event.
As soon as I start thinking about free speech, it kind of like creates this weird fog in my brain where it feels like it is actually just such a disorienting frame of what's happening. You know, it reminds me of in October, November, December of last year, after October 7th, all you saw in the media was just, does Israel have a right to exist? You almost have to, it's like a prerequisite to answer that question before people were interviewed. And it feels like it's a similar mechanism that's happening here, where it's like, instead of talking about what, you know, valid claims someone might have for opposing Netanyahu, or what kind of anti-war mandate the student union might have, you know, to back them, it becomes this question of, but wait, do you think people should be able to speak freely?
Yeah, it is kind of a trap. And I think this question of, yeah, do you think Israel has a right to exist? Or also, do you or do you not condemn Hamas? Like, these questions that get thrown at people before they can even say what it is that they really came to the table to say. Yeah, it kind of is this like distraction tactic. You get caught up in defending the nuances of free speech and like free speech versus hate speech.
Yeah, I think, I mean, for me, this question of even like, what does it mean to have the right to free speech anyway? Like, where does that come from? Like, there's no innate rights to anything. Like, I think that's also the kind of the problem with human rights discourse sometimes, is that it feels like there's this kind of idea that there's this, something has been granted for all of us as if we're answering to some higher power, when really what the issue is at hand is that there's this war criminal that shouldn't be occupying space on campus, and people have a problem with that. So they're exercising direct action and protest, and that can be successful or not successful. It can have its own consequences. There can be mistakes made, but when you get bogged down in the kind of politics of the right to speak, it makes it such an abstract question, rather than just like, what are the consequences of this particular event, and what are you doing to either facilitate or dissent from them?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I think at the same time, you know, there kind of is this higher power of like, there are free speech protections in Canada, and Concordia's Code of Rights and Responsibilities, even though it was then, you know, conveniently suspended as soon as it's like, okay, wait, we have to discipline these students for doing something that this code protects, which is, you know, academic freedom. And this states that neither the university nor any of its members shall condone any conduct which adversely affects the university or any of its members. And we look at this and it's like, okay, but what happens when these groups feel adversely affected by one another's actions? I think similarly, under free speech protections in Canada, like, this isn't meant to support violence or threats of violence. And like, I think a lot of us would consider that the presence of someone like Netanyahu on campus, or really, you know, on this planet, a threat of violence.
Free speech argument is a smokescreen.
No, it's not a smokescreen.
It is, the way you're using it, because we believe in free speech.
Okay, so you're
this has nothing to do with free speech. It's the most abstract.
No,
it's the most abstract way of looking at free speech, and divorcing it from any reality of power dynamics. You shut off a whole area of campus.
And then the Arab students are supposed to come onto campus that day and be good Arabs and like put their heads down and say,
No,
I'm going to take my books. I'm going to walk in the building on the side.
Yeah, Jay, yeah, I'm not saying that.
We have all these discussions about free speech and the role of the CSU, and this led to, in the following election, the ousting of the then current CSU execs, one, and then two, voting in record numbers this kind of so-called apolitical party, Evolution Not Revolution. And there was a few parties that ran, but the main two were Evolution Not Revolution and Clean Slate, who presented themselves as still leftist, but not as radical as the current party, who I believe were endorsing them. And they didn't share any members, but students seemed unconvinced that it would be a big enough change.
So what ultimately happened is, in March of 2003, so 6 months after the riot, Concordia students had the opportunity to go to the polls. And back then, elections operated on a kind of party basis, so there was actually a slate of execs that got voted in at the same time. It really was kind of like a sweeping change when you changed from one slate to another, as opposed to now where people are voted in for particular roles. And the Hillel-backed party Evolution Not Revolution won by a vote of more than 2-1, so more than double the votes over Clean Slate, and really appealed to the students that were sort of fed up by the what they saw as an over-politicization of student government. And this election absolutely smashed the previous voter turnout by having more than 4,000 people cast ballots. And just for some context of this, in our second episode on the radicalization of the student government in 1999, we talked about how impressive it was that they had gotten about 1,500 people to cast ballots then. And so just to give some context, you know, this really tripled that number.
It's interesting to see how basically the thing that got students interested enough or worked up enough to participate in student politics was just kind of like, they're basically voting to be able to go back to not thinking about it.
It's so true. Yeah, the thing that politicized students to vote was in order to not have to hear about politics anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, they're like, okay, I'm gonna participate in the politics so I don't have to hear about these dang politics anymore. On the topic, though, of participating in student politics, as Ali mentioned, there's this SGM, or Special General Meeting, coming up on January 29th, so 2 days from this original air date. This is something that all Concordia undergraduate students can participate in, and it's a really important moment for Concordia, I think. And so if you're listening, would very much encourage you to go listen and be present and participate in this vote. It is also essential that people be in person. You know, the vote can't go through if they don't reach quorum.
Yeah, so 450 students is the standard quorum for an SGM, or Special General Meeting. And basically this petition demands actions like demanding a full transparency of Concordia's financial investments, ending the partnerships with several companies, including Bombardier and Lockheed Martin, which are weapons manufacturers, and also ending partnerships with Israeli academic institutions and committing to limiting the presence of the Montreal police and cutting security contracts with Percentage International.
Maybe the way I sound sometimes is like I don't like my experience at Concordia, but it's not true. I really did like it. It's amazing because it opened all these different perspectives to me. And so also that, you know, the university, it's, who's the university? Is it the administration or is it the students, the faculty and the support staff? We thought that the university should be run by students, teachers and support staff, you know, not by administrators.
Thank you to Omar, Aaron Lakoff, Ali Salman, and Sabine Friesinger for their interviews, our volunteers, and to the CRFC Radio Meters Program for funding Discordia.
2002 soundbites are from the NFB documentary Discordia by Ben Edelman and Samir Malal, as well as the student film Student Politics and Confrontation at Concordia. Contact us at discordia@cglo.com with questions or to get involved. You can find this episode, as well as part one, in the archives at cglo.com, on SoundCloud and Spotify.
Tune in on Monday, February 10th at 6 p.m. for our next episode on the 2012 tuition strikes, also known as the Maple Spring, on CJLO 1690 AM and CJLO.com.